From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Banshees. Of all Irish ghosts, fairies, or bogles, the banshee is the best known to the general public. She is a spirit with a lengthy pedigree. How lengthy no man can say, as its roots go back into the dim, mysterious past. The most famous banshee of ancient times was that attached to the kingly house of O'Brien, Abe Hill, who haunted the rock of Craig Lee above Killaloe, near the old palace of Kincora. In A.D. 1014 was fought the Battle of Clontarf, from which the aged King Brian Boru knew that he would never come away alive. For the previous night, Abe Hill had appeared to him to tell him of his impending fate. The Banshee's methods of foretelling death in olden times differed from that adopted by her at the present day. Now she wails and wrings her hands, as a general rule, but in the old Irish tales, she is found to be washing human heads and limbs, or blood-stained clothes, till the waters all dyed with human blood. This would take place before a battle. So it would seem that in the course of centuries, her attributes and characteristics have changed somewhat. Very different descriptions are given of her personal appearance. Sometimes she is young and beautiful, sometimes old and of a fearsome appearance. One writer describes her as a tall, thin woman with uncovered head and long hair that floated around her shoulders, attired in something which seemed either a loose white cloak or a sheet thrown hastily around her, uttering piercing cries. Another person, a coachman, saw her one evening, sitting on a stile in the yard. She seemed to be a very small woman with blue eyes, long light hair, and wearing a red cloak. It does not seem to be true that the Banshee exclusively follows families of Irish descent, for the last incidence has reference to the death of a member of a County Galway family, English by name and origin. One of the oldest and best-known Banshee stories is that related in the memoirs of Lady Fanshawe. In 1642, her husband, Sir Richard, and she chanced to visit a friend, the head of an Irish sept, who resided in his ancient baronial castle surrounded with a moat. At midnight, she was awakened by a ghastly and supernatural scream, and looking out of bed, beheld in the moonlight a female face and part of the form hovering at the window. The distance from the ground as well as the circumstance of the moat excluded the possibility that what she beheld was of this world. The face was that of a young and rather handsome woman, but pale, and the hair, which was reddish, was loose and disheveled. The dress, which Lady Fanshawe's terror did not prevent her remarking accurately, was that of the ancient Irish. This apparition continued to exhibit itself for some time, and then vanished, with two shrieks similar to that which had first excited Lady Fanshawe's attention. In the morning, with infinite terror, she communicated to her host what she had witnessed, and found him prepared not only to credit, but to account for the superstition. "A near relation of my family," said he, "expired last night in this castle. We disguised our certain expectation of the event from you, lest it should throw a cloud over the cheerful reception which was your due. Now, before such an event happens in this family or castle, the female specter whom you have seen is always visible. She is believed to be the spirit of a woman of inferior rank, whom one of my ancestors degraded himself by marrying, and whom afterwards, to expiate the dishonor done to his family, he caused to be drowned in the moat. In strictness, this woman could hardly be termed a banshee. The motive for the haunting is akin to that in the tale of the Scotch drummer of Cordaghy. where the spirit of the murdered man haunts the family out of revenge and appears before death. Mr. T.J. Westropp has furnished the following story. My maternal grandmother heard the following tradition from her mother, one of the Miss Ross Lewins, who witnessed the occurrence. Their father, Mr. Harrison Ross Lewin, was away in Dublin on law business, and in his absence the young people went off to spend the evening with a friend who lived some miles away. The night was fine and lightsome as they were returning, save at one point where the road ran between trees or high hedges not far to the west of the old church of Gilchrist. The latter, like many similar ruins, was a simple oblong building with long side walls and high gables, and at that time it and its graveyard were unclosed and lay in the open field. As a party passed down the long dark lane, they suddenly heard in the distance loud keening and clapping of hands, as the country people were accustomed to do when lamenting the dead. The Ross Lewins hurried on and came inside of the church, on the side wall of which a little gray-haired old woman, clad in a dark cloak, was running to and fro, chanting and wailing, and throwing up her arms. The girls were very frightened, but the young man ran forward and surrounded the ruin, and two of them went into the church, the apparition vanishing from the wall as they did so. They searched every nook and found no one, nor did anyone pass out. All were now well scared, and got home as fast as possible. On reaching their home, their mother opened a door, and at once told them that she was in terror about their father, for as she sat looking out the window in the moonlight, a huge raven with fiery eyes lit on the sill and tapped 3 times on the glass. They told her their story, which only added to their anxiety, and as they stood talking, taps came to the nearest window, and they saw the bird again. A few days later, news reached them that Mr. Ross Lewin had died suddenly in Dublin. This occurred about 1776. Mr. Westropp also writes that the sister of a former Roman Catholic bishop told his sisters that when she was a little girl, she went out one evening with some other children for a walk. Going down the road, they passed the gate of the principal demesne near the town. There was a rock or large stone beside the road on which they saw something. Going nearer, they perceived it to be a little dark old woman, who began crying and clapping her hands. Some of them attempted to speak to her, but got frightened and all finally ran home as quickly as they could. Next day the news came that the gentleman near whose gate the banshee had cried was dead, and it was found on inquiry that he had died at the very hour at which the children had seen the specter.
A lady, who was a relation of one of the compilers and a member of the County Cork family of English descent, sends the two following experiences of a banshee in her family. My mother, when a young girl, was standing looking out of the window in their house at Black Rock near Cork. She suddenly saw a white figure standing on a bridge which was easily visible from the house. The figure waved her arms towards the house, and my mother heard the bitter wailing of the banshee. It lasted some seconds, and then the figure disappeared. Next morning, my grandfather was walking as usual into the city of Cork. He accidentally fell, hit his head against the curbstone, and never recovered consciousness. In March 1900, my mother was very ill, and one evening the nurse and I were with her arranging her bed. We suddenly heard the most extraordinary wailing, which seemed to come in waves round and under her bed. We naturally looked everywhere to try and find the cause, but in vain. The nurse and I looked at one another, but made no remark, as my mother did not seem to hear it. My sister was downstairs sitting with my father. She heard it, and thought some terrible thing had happened to her little boy, who was in bed upstairs. She rushed up and found him sleeping quietly. My father did not hear it. In the house next door they heard it, and ran downstairs, thinking something had happened to the servant. But the latter at once said to them, "Did you hear the banshee? Mrs. P. must be dying." A few years ago, before 1894, a curious incident occurred in a public school in connection with a belief in the banshee. One of the boys, happening to become ill, was at once placed in a room by himself, where he used to sit all day. On one occasion, as he was being visited by the doctor, he suddenly started up,
from his seat and affirmed that he heard someone crying. The doctor, of course, who could hear or see nothing, came to the conclusion that the illness had slightly affected his brain. However, the boy, who appeared quite sensible, still persisted that he heard someone crying, and furthermore said, "It is the banshee, as I have heard it before." The following morning, the headmaster received a telegram saying that the boy's brother had been accidentally shot dead. That the banshee is not confined within the geographical limits of Ireland, but that she can follow the fortunes of a family abroad and there foretell their death is clearly shown by the following story. A party of visitors were gathered together on the deck of a private yacht on one of the Italian lakes, and during a lull in the conversation, one of them, a colonel, said to the owner, "Count, who's that queer-looking woman you have on board?" The count replied that there was nobody except the ladies present and the stewardess, but the speaker protested that he was correct, and suddenly with a scream of horror he placed his hands before his eyes and exclaimed, "Oh my God, what a face!" For some time he was overcome with terror, and at length reluctantly looked up and cried, "Thank heavens, it's gone!" "What was it?" asked the count. "Nothing human," replied the colonel, "nothing belonging to this world. It was a woman of no earthly type, with a queer-shaped, gleaming face, a mass of red hair, and eyes that would have been beautiful but for their expression, which was hellish. She had on a green hood, after the fashion of an Irish peasant." An American lady present suggested that the description tallied with that of the banshee, upon which the count said, "I am an O'Neill. At least I am descended from one. My family name, as you know, Nelsini, which little more than a century ago was O'Neill. My great-grandfather served in the Irish Brigade, and on its dissolution, at the time of the French Revolution, had the good fortune to escape the general massacre of officers, and in company with an O'Brien and a Maguire, fled across the frontier and settled in Italy. On his death, his son, who had been born in Italy and was far more Italian than Irish, changed his name to Nelsini, by which name the family has been known ever since. But for all that, we are Irish." "The banshee was yours, then?" ejaculated the colonel. "What exactly does it mean?" "It means," the count replied solemnly, "the death of someone very nearly associated with me. Pray heaven it is not my wife or daughter." On that score, however, his anxiety was speedily removed, for within 2 hours he was seized with a violent attack of angina pectoris and died before morning. Mr. Elliot O'Donnell, to whose article on banshees we are indebted for the above, adds, "The banshee never manifests itself to the person whose death is prognosticating. Other people may see or hear it, but the fated one never, so that when everyone present is aware of it but one, the fate of that one may be regarded as pretty well certain." 20 years experience as a ghost hunter. By Elliot O'Donnell. I was born in the 70s. My father came from County Limerick and belonged to the Truagh Castle O'Donnells, who, tracing their descent from Shane Luarg, the elder brother of Niall Garb, the ancestor of Red Hugh, rightly claimed to be the oldest branch of the great clan. He graduated at Trinity College, Dublin, was for some time vicar of a parish near Worcester, and died in Egypt, under mysterious and much discussed circumstances, soon after I came into the world. My mother was English. She belonged to an old Midland family, and only survived my father a few years. Although I am generally known as a ghost hunter, needless to say, it was not for such a career that I was educated, first of all at Clifton College, then at an Army Crammer's, and finally at Chedwode Crawley's, well-known coaching establishment in Ely Place, Dublin. There, I read for the Royal Irish Constabulary, and, attending regularly, remained for a little over 2 years. I can safely say these 2 years were two of the happiest I have ever known, for my companions at that time were the nicest set of fellows I've ever met, and amongst them I formed many lifelong friendships. When I was not working, I usually spent my time playing football or cricket, to both of which sports I was devoted, and when I was not thus engaged, I used to tramp across hill and dale, continually exploring the country in search of adventure. But in those days I did not look for ghosts. They came to me. They came to me then, as they had come to me before, and as they have come to me ever since. With my experiences of the unknown, which experiences, by the way, extend over the whole period of my youth, I've dealt fully in former works, so that in this volume I propose to confine myself to later experiences, commencing approximately with my debut as an investigator of haunted houses and superphysical occurrences in general. To begin with, however, let me state plainly that I lay no claims to being what is termed a scientific psychic researcher. I'm not a member of any august society that conducts its investigations of the other world or worlds with test tube and weighing apparatus. Neither do I pretend to be a medium or consistent clairvoyant. I'm merely a ghost hunter. Merely one who honestly believes that he inherits in some degree the faculty of psychic perceptiveness from a long line of Celtic ancestry, and who is and always has been deeply and genuinely interested in all questions relative to phantasms and a continuance of individual life after physical dissolution. Moreover, in addition to this psychic faculty, I possess, as I have already hinted, a spirit of adventure, and since the spirit is irresistible, had I not decided to become a ghost hunter, I should doubtless have embarked upon some other and hardly less exciting pursuit. The actual cause of my decision to adopt ghost hunting as a profession was an experience which befell me in the summer of 92. I was at that time a student in Ely Place, Dublin, and being in search of rooms, was recommended to try a house within a stone's throw of the Waterloo Road. A widow named Davis, with two Leviathan daughters, Mona and Bridget, ran the establishment, and as the vacant apartments were large, apparently well ventilated, and exceedingly moderate in price, I decided to take them. Consequently, I arrived there with my luggage one afternoon and was speedily engaged in the tiring and somewhat irritating task of unpacking. When I retired to rest that first night, I certainly had no thought of ghosts or anything in connection with them. On the contrary, my mind was wholly occupied with speculations as to how I should fare in the coming weekly examination at Crawley's, where the extra attention I recently bestowed on mathematics would be of any service to me, or whether, in spite of it, I should again occupy my place at the bottom of the class. I remember thinking, however, as I blew out the light and turned into bed, that there was something about the room now, that I could not tell what, that I had not noticed by daylight. But I soon went to sleep, and although I woke several times before morning, a phenomenon in itself, I cannot say that I thought then of any superphysical element in the atmosphere. It was not until I had been there several nights that the event occurred which effectually shaped my future career. One evening, the two girls, Mona and Bridget, were making so much racket in the room beneath me that I found work impossible. And being somewhat tired, for I had stuck very close to it all day, I resolved to go to bed. On my way thither, I encountered two young men, TC students, who were also lodging in the house, hotly engaged in an argument, and they appealed to me to express an opinion. I told them what I thought, as they followed me upstairs. Then, when I reached my room, I abruptly bade them good night, and entering, locked the door behind me. Sitting down on the edge of the bed, I quietly slipped off my clothes and put out the light. The two men were still haranguing one another, for they were all worth when I got in between the sheets and prepared to lie down. The room was not entirely dark. From between the folds of the thick plush curtains that enveloped the windows, stray beams from the powerful moonlight filtered through and battled their way to the foot of the bed. I was looking at them with some degree of curiosity when I saw something move. I glanced at it in astonishment and to my unmeditated horror. The shape of something dark and sinister rose noiselessly from the floor and came swiftly towards me. I tried to shout, but could not make a sound. I was completely paralyzed. As I sat there, sick with fear and apprehension, the thing leaped onto me, and gripping me mercilessly by the throat, bore me backwards. I gasped and choked and suffered the most excruciating pain, But there was no relaxation. The pressure of those bony fingers only tightened, and the torture went on. At last, after what seemed to me an eternity, there was a loud buzzing in my ears. My head seemed to spin round violently, and my brain to burst. I lost consciousness. On coming to, I found that my assailant had left me. I struck a light. My fellow lodgers were still going at one another, hammer and tongs, and the door was, as I had left it, locked on the inside. I searched the room thoroughly. The window was bolted. There was nothing in the cupboard, nothing under the bed, nothing anywhere. I got into bed again, full of the worst anticipations, and if sleep came to me, it was only in the briefest snatches. At dawn, the room became suffused with a cold gray glow, and the suggestion of something horribly evil standing close beside the bed and sardonically watching me impressed me so strongly that, yielding to a sudden impulse of terror, I hid my head under the bedclothes and remained in that undignified position till the morning was well advanced and I was called. I got up feeling downright ill, and although the sunlight metamorphosing everything now made the mere thought of a ghost simply ludicrous, I hurried out of the room as speedily as possible, nor did I venture to pass another night there. My landlady did not demur when I asked her to transfer me to another apartment, and later, before I took my final departure from her house, she confessed to me that it was haunted. She believed that it had been used as a private home for mentally afflicted people, and that someone, either one of the patients or a nurse, she did not know which, had died under extremely painful circumstances in the room I had first occupied. The Davises left the house soon after I did, and who lives there now, and whether the hauntings still continue, I cannot say. When I last made inquiries about 2 years ago, I learned that the then occupants had never admitted experiencing anything unusual, but that they always kept the room in which I had undergone the sensation of strangulation carefully locked. This adventure of mine, intensely unpleasant as it had been at the time, profoundly interested me. Hitherto, I had placidly accepted as truth all the dogmas of religion hurled at me from the pulpit and drilled into me at school, for the simple reason that I had always been taught to regard as infinitely correct and absolutely above criticism all that the clergy told me. God made the world, they said, and all the laws and principles appertaining to it. That was sufficient. I need not ask any questions. When I looked about me and saw men and women, dogs, horses, and other animals suffering indescribable agonies from all kinds of foul and malignant diseases, when I encountered cripples, the maimed and blind, idiots and lunatics, or read the papers of swindles, murders, and suicides, or noted how throughout nature the strong animals prey upon the weak, how, for example, the tiger, the lion, and the leopard terrorized the jungle, just as the shark and octopus terrorized the sea, and the wasp and spider, centipede and scorpion terrorized insect life, being furnished respectively with weapons for tearing and rending and sucking the flesh and entailing the most excruciating tortures on the nerve centers. When I say I noted all this, I was given to understand that I must on no account comment upon it. To do so was impious and wicked. I must abide by the precept of my pastor and pedagogue, namely, that God is almighty, merciful, loving, and wise. But now it was different. I was no longer in the schoolroom, no longer under the immediate influence of the church. I met people in Dublin imbued with the broader instincts of a big cosmopolitan community. I listened to their reasoning which at first immeasurably shocked me, and afterward struck me as horribly sane. Then, at this crisis came the incident of the strangling. I tried to attribute it to a dream, but I was prevented by the fact that I had only just got into bed, and not even lain down when the figure seized me. Hence, I could only conclude that some spirit, the nature of my suffering, and the horror it inspired, leading me to suppose that it was a particularly evil one, had been my aggressor. But why was it not in hell? Had it escaped in spite of the strict supervision of the Almighty? Or could it be impossible that the orthodox paradise and purgatory did not exist, and the spirits of the dead were allowed to wander about at will? I became interested, deeply so. All sorts of wild speculations floated through my mind. I resolved to inquire further. Several of my friends in Dublin were greatly interested in ghosts, and I learned from them of two houses that had long borne the reputation of being haunted. One was close to St. Stephen's Green, within sight of the Queen's Service Academy, and the other big ugly edifice of a dingy grey was in Black Rock. I had stayed in the former when a child, and had vivid recollections of the holes in the stone stairs through which boiling oil was poured on the heads of the English soldiers of the time of the 98. There were many large and stately rooms in the house, oak-paneled and beautified throughout with much carving. I remember looking with awe and perplexity at the number of odd shadows that used to put in an appearance on the stairs and in the passages, just when it was my bedtime, but I did not then attribute them to ghosts. I simply did not know what they were. I heard sounds too, clangs and clashes and footsteps tramping up and down the stairs, sounds I did not attempt to analyze, possibly because I dared not. That was in 1886. I was then a small boy, and now only after I had long left the house and was back in Dublin, with the experiences of the strangling ghost still fresh in my mind, I began to wonder whether these strange sounds and shadows might not have been due to the presence of the superphysical. I mentioned the matter to my friends, and they expressed astonishment that I had not heard the house was haunted. One of them, a lady, told me that she had once stayed there, and had been awakened every night by the sounds I had described, the sounds of heavy footsteps rushing up the stairs, of cries and groans, shrieks and oaths, coupled with the clashing of scabbards and sword blades and the sound as of falling bodies. Yet nothing was ever to be seen, saving the moonlight and shadows, plenty of shadows, shadows strangely suggestive of grotesque and fancifully clad people. I tried to obtain permission to sleep in the house, and in my innocence of the ways of landlords, I stated with the most pathetic candor my true intention. I wanted to investigate. The reply I got was certainly not courteous, neither did it permit of argument. Hence, feeling considerably crestfallen and humiliated, I found myself forced to give up my first attempt at ghost hunting. Then I turned my attention to the house in Black Rock, and fared no better. The landlord had been bothered to death with requests to spend nights there, and was endeavoring to discover the originator of the report that the place was haunted, in order that he might bring an action for slander of title. Consequently, I could only examine the house from the outside, hoping that its ghostly inhabitants would one night take pity on me and exhibit themselves at one of the windows. But in this, too, I was disappointed, although, as the place invariably inspired me with the greatest dread, I have no doubt whatever but that it was genuinely and badly haunted. There were several stories in circulation in Dublin about that time concerning the nature of the haunting, and the following. One of the most reliable was told me by a Mrs. Blake. I will give it nearly as I can in her own words. When I was a child of about 12, she began, which was a good many years ago, my father, who was then stationed in Dublin, took the house on a 3 years lease at a very low rental, due, so the owner stated, to the fact that there were far too many stairs, a feature to which most people, on account of their servants, strongly objected. Nothing was said about ghosts, and nothing was further from my parents' minds when they took possession. We moved in towards the end of July, but it was not until the middle of September that we first became aware that the house was haunted. It happened in this way. My father and the maids were out one evening, and only my mother, my small brother, and I were in the house. It was about 8 o'clock. I was upstairs in the nursery reading to Teddy, and my mother was in the drawing room, two stories beneath. I was just in the middle of a sentence when Teddy interrupted me. "Did you hear that?" he exclaimed. "It's someone on the stairs. I believe they are listening." I paused and heard a loud creak. "Who can it be?" I said. "There's only mother in the house." Much mystified, I closed the book and went out to the landing. No one was there, but when I got to the head of the stairs, I heard a loud scream, and then a dull thud, just as if someone had fallen. In an agony of mind, I ran downstairs to see what had happened. As I arrived in the hall, the door of the drawing room was slowly opened, and I saw peeping cautiously out a white face with two dark, gleaming, obliquely set eyes that filled with an expression of the most diabolical hatred as they met mine. I was so terrified that I started back some paces, and as I did so, the door opened a little wider, and the figure of a short, elderly woman, clad in an old-fashioned black dress and white cap crumpled closely around her lean, haggard face, glided out and, passing by, ascended the stairs. As she came to the first bend, she turned, and looking down at me with an evil leer, shook her hand menacingly at me. She then passed out of sight, and I heard her climb the stairs step by step, till she came to the nursery landing. A moment later, and Teddy gave a violent shriek. My terror was now so great that I think I should have gone mad had I been left there any longer by myself. But by a merciful providence, a key turned in the lock of the front door, and my father entered. The sight of his well-known figure on the threshold at once loosened the spell that had bound me, and with a cry of delight, I clutched him by the arm, imploring him to see at once what had happened to Mother and Teddy. He ran into the drawing room first, and found my mother on the floor just reviving from a faint. Lighting the gas, he fetched her some brandy, and then, bidding me stay with her, he hastened upstairs to Teddy. The latter was very badly frightened, and it was some days before he was well enough to give anything like a coherent account of what had happened. Of course, Mother and Father told Teddy that the queer figure they had seen was some friend of the servants who had called while they were out, but I suppose they deemed me old enough to know the truth, for they discussed the incident openly in my presence. It appears that my mother had been quietly knitting in the drawing room when she suddenly felt very cold, and rising from her chair with the intention of closing the door, found herself confronted by a hideous form. Subsequently, my father made a thorough search of the house, but he found no one, and as all the windows were fastened and the doors locked on the inside, we could only come to the conclusion that the figure my mother and Teddy and I had all seen was a ghost. A few days later appeared to my father. He was coming out of his bedroom when he saw a woman steal stealthily out of a room on the same landing and creep downstairs in front of him. There was something about her so intensely sinister that he felt chilled, but determining to find out who she was, he followed her, and catching up to her, demanded her name. There was a chuckling answer. The figure instantly disappeared, and a number of invisible somethings clattered down the stairs past him. I think my father was very scared. At all events, he came into the breakfast room with a very white face and ate hardly anything. Some time after this, when the autumn was well advanced, my uncle came to stay with us. He was a jolly, rollicking sailor who had fought the Turks at Navarino and had had many exciting adventures with Chinese pirates. No one told him the house was haunted. It was decided he should find that out for himself. One afternoon, several days after his arrival, he was taking off his boots in a room in the basement when a current of icy air blew in on him, and on raising his eyes to see whence the draught came, he perceived an extraordinarily pretty girl, clad in a dark green riding habit, such as he believed were worn in the days of his great-grandparents, standing in the doorway, watching him intently. This is one of Jack's surprises. Jack was my father, he said to himself, and a deuced pleasant one, too. The rogue, he knows, nothing pleases me so much as the sight of a pretty girl, and by Jove, she's pretty. Springing to his feet, for my uncle was never bashful in the presence of the fair sex, he advanced to shake hands. To his chagrin, however, she promptly turned around, and walking swiftly away, began to ascend the stairs. My uncle followed her. On and on she led him till she came to the drawing room. There she paused, and with the forefinger of her left hand on her lips, glanced coyly around at him. She then quietly turned the door handle, and signaling for him to follow, stole into the room on tiptoe. Charmed with this piece of acting, the naivety of it appealing very strongly to his susceptible nature, my uncle hastened after her. The moment he crossed the threshold, however, he recoiled. Standing in the middle of the room was an old woman with a hideous white face and black, leering eyes. There were no signs anywhere of the young and beautiful lady. She had completely vanished. My uncle was so shocked by the spectacle before him that he retreated onto the landing, and as he did so, the drawing-room door swung to with a loud crash. He called my father, and they entered the room together, but it was quite empty. The old hag had disappeared as inexplicably as the girl. That evening there was to be a party, and the table in the dining room groaned beneath the weight of one of those illimitable spreads in vogue some 50 or 60 years ago. With somewhat pardonable pride, my mother took us all, my father, uncle, and myself, to have a peep at it before the guests arrived. As we drew near the room, we heard to our astonishment the plaintive sound of a spinet. My mother instantly drew back, trembling, whereupon my uncle, forcing a laugh, said, "This is one of the occasions upon which a gentleman should go first." He threw open the door as he spoke, and we all peered in. What I saw will never be effaced from my memory. The room exhibited a complete wreckage. The cloth was half off the table. The massive silver candlesticks were overturned, and the floor was strewn with piles of broken glass, china, and eatables. Everything was smashed and ruined. In the midst of the debris, her face turned towards us, lay a very beautiful girl. They were unmistakable evidence of a ghastly wound, but her eyes were partly open. The strange light which gleamed from their blue depths revealed an expression which could only have been hatched in hell, a hell peopled not with passive, torture-torn sufferers, but with woefully abandoned beings actively engaged in licentiousness and everything that is destructive and antagonistic to a man's moral and mental progress. Standing over the woman and holding a kind of stiletto in his hand was a tall, fair man, and whose agonized and remorseful features we recognized at once, almost certainly likeness to my uncle. No detail was wanting. There was the deep scar on the temple, the curiously deep dimple in the chin. Indeed, saving for the old-fashioned clothes, no likeness could have been more exact. Standing by his side, her hideous scowling face thrust forward, her evil eyes glaring at us with the same vindictive insolence, was the old woman I had seen that night in the hall. Then my father, uttering some exclamation, crossed himself, and as he did so, the figures abruptly vanished, while the whole house echoed and re-echoed with loud peals of mocking, diabolical laughter. That was the finale. We left immediately afterwards, and from that day to this, the house, I believe, has stood almost uninterruptedly empty. This is the gist of Mrs. Blake's account of the happenings, and as I never found her anything but strictly truthful, I believe them to have been given me without any conscious exaggeration.